so we are going to officially start our session today. This is Susan Elks, the Professional Development Officer from the PA chapter. I am going to be starting on the beginning of this and then switching back and forth with Christine Bartleson on different topic areas. Today's agenda, you can see up on the screen. I'm going to be doing the background and tips and then switching to Chris for the history. I'll be doing plan making and functional. Chris will be doing spatial, and then I'll finish up with the public and the ethics. The most important point I want to make off of this slide is basically the percentages we have shown here, that is from the APA outline of material. You need to study according to that outline and according to your own background. If you're a transportation planner and that's what you do every day, day in and day out, you obviously are not going to have to spend a lot of time studying there. You need to study other areas that you're less familiar with. Sometimes the amount of material that's available in an area doesn't really match this allocation. There's lots of information available for history and law, but you've got to keep in mind that's only 15% of the test content. Plan making, functional, and spatial, which overlap greatly and kind of blend together after a while, those make up 70% of the exam. Typically speaking, that's not necessarily 70% of the study material you will find out there. So just make sure that you are studying according to this outline and then according to your own background. This is pretty straightforward. The test is 170 questions. They are all multiple choice. There's no essays or anything like that. Within that 170, scattered around, you will not know which ones are 20 sample questions that APA is doing a test run of, essentially, to see if they're good, to see if they should include them for real on future tests. So if you are taking the exam and you come across a question that you think is just worded really terrible and it's awful and you have no idea what the answer would be, hopefully that's just a sample question, and hopefully it'll be thrown out. It is 3.5 hours for the test. You have this brief little tutorial beforehand so that you can get familiar with the computer that you're sitting at and how you advance and things like that. That takes about 15 minutes. So all total, you could be sitting in this room in the testing center for almost 4 hours to take the exam. The scoring is on a scale. I'm not even going to attempt to explain how that works. APA has some information on their website going into that. The pass rate is approximately 65%, and that's pretty standard. It goes up and down in various years, but it's almost always in the 60 range. So just keep in mind that a fair amount of people who take this exam do fail it, but of course more pass it. And I personally think studying is the big difference in studying the right materials. APA also has some information they've collected on who passes best, and I think it comes out to be people who are not that far removed from school, so they have, you know, perhaps some more of the history and the theory and that, like, already fresh in their minds, and then people who have their degrees actually in a planning degree as opposed to something else, pass at a slightly higher rate. The test centers right now, those are Prometric, is who the test is done through. Make sure you arrive early, get your paperwork done, make sure your IDs match name and spelling with the authorization of the test that APA has sent you. Some basic test things there. They do provide you with a calculator, paper, and pencil. You can't take anything in the room at all with you. Basic tip is to start studying early and to keep going at it in short rounds. This is not a cram the night before test at all. Identify your weak areas and make sure that you're studying the things that APA has noted on their outline that you are less familiar with. Study groups, some people find them very helpful. Practice exams can be very helpful. And then again, just making use of the resources that are appropriate for your background that you have. And to just go a little bit more into some of the questions and the type of questions that are on the exam. They are all multiple choice. It's all going to be multiple choice in some format or another. That is not to say that they're going to be easy questions. In particular, with the plan making and the functional and the spatial and the public participation as well, APA stresses process and your planning approach. They're not asking you simple things for the most part. This question, I don't want to go into great detail about it. I just want to point out a couple things, you know, underline them if you've printed out the slides in advance. I will read the question anyway. An urban municipality has received grant funding to restore riparian buffers in order to improve the untreated water quality of the municipality's public water, which is drawn partially from surface waters. Which of the following steps is not necessary to get the project underway? This is a process question. It's an approach question. That's why it's here, to give you an example of that. It's got a lot of different parts to it. You don't know which one to pay attention to when you read it. As you work your way through the answers, you can kind of see, you start splitting things up into, like, this sounds feasible for this type of project, maybe this is less feasible. In the end, you'll read through all these and you'll think, well, these all are kind of reasonable for this. On this one, what you need to be paying attention to are the fact that they're treating water quality of the municipality's public water source, because that's what the grant funding is for, and that they're asking you what's not necessary to get the project underway. So what are some of the earlier steps versus steps that could come later? The answer for this one is B, determining ownership of parcels along all surface waters within the municipality. Ownership is something that can come later, and you don't even need to do it along all surface waters within the municipality, because those may not be the public water source. So I think that's a pretty realistic question for the exam, just in terms of its process, its approach, and it's got some different parts. It's not a trick question, but you definitely have to read it and, you know, pick the best answer. It's not necessarily that four things are wrong and one thing is right, but there's a best answer among it. This is an example of how APA could ask you about people. They're not going to ask you a real clear-cut one, but they're not going to hide things. They're asking you about advocacy planning in this. They're naming a couple of people, and then they're asking for the effect of the movement. And the answer is B on this one. This question is to give you an example of a tiered question. There will definitely be some of these on the exam. APA seems to like these. The answer is D, by the way. I'm not going to go into the details of why. We have a lot devoted to law a little bit later in the session. But what I wanted to point out is just that you can definitely get this type of a question on the exam, where you have to sort out and know what's going on. And then this kind of leads into the next question, which is, again, a law question. And in this one, they are giving you some information. They're talking about a case. They're telling you that it's about takings. So if we go back to the previous one, this question is asking you what's about takings. This question is telling you that this case is about takings. APA may do this within the 170 questions they give you. They will not necessarily be back-to-back like this. So as you're taking the exam, you may want to take notes on the paper they provide you, or you may want to use the marking option that is available within the computer system to mark certain things. Mark all law cases, or again, take notes on them. My point just being that sometimes you can use a bit of information from one thing to help you with an answer on something else. And which one is this? The answer is B on this, by the way, if you're keeping track of that. Okay. So those are just some examples of how the test might actually look. And now I'm going to get into some of the resources that there are for studying for the exam. This is the page, the AICP exam page from the Pennsylvania chapter, and it's this page that these slides are actually available on, the very bottom of this page. So the planningpa.org, the AICP exam under the Career Center, these slides are going to be there, and pretty much anything we've put together in the past about the exam to help you study for it is on this page. We have the prior sessions like this. We have some ethics presentation, an ethics scenario. We have how you can contact us to obtain the Chapter President's Council or the CPC manual. We have links to other chapters. I want to point out right now that I know that our link to Colorado is out of date, and we will certainly be updating that because Colorado does have some good information. And they do have a link right now to someone else's website that's really pretty good. It's an individual planner who took the test last year, and she's got some good information. So we need to update our link to Colorado, but Colorado is a good site. And the PDC study notes, that is something that the Pennsylvania Professional Development Committee has put together. It's about 130 pages long, I think. I would call it a comprehensive source for studying for the exam, and I don't mean that in terms of we have absolutely everything you're ever going to want to know, but I mean that in terms of, you know, we touch on every content area that APA has identified in their outline: history, theory, law, plan making, functional, spatial, public, and ethics. You will still need to go to other sources to find out more information on certain areas where you may be weak or where you just want more information, but I would call that one of the comprehensive sources that's available. So that's what our webpage looks like right now. APA obviously has a lot of information for you. The AICP Exam Prep 2.0, I would also call that a comprehensive source. You get a booklet and a CD. The CD has practice exams on it that it will score for you. So that can be very useful. Ethics information is available on the APA website, the actual code, and then some other additional things for that. Policy guides in the top 25. These are things where you can find out what APA called important and what APA thinks is best on a particular issue. Through this presentation, we're going to identify policy guides as they're relevant in the different content areas. Certainly, if there's an area that you are less familiar with, I would read the APA policy guide on it. It'll help you know what APA really thinks is the important thing to know about an area. The timeline is really important. And it's a nice, clean way to have things laid out in front of you. The exam candidate bulletin, we're not going to go into today the actual application process and all of that stuff. It's an exam candidate bulletin on its own. Definitely, I would just go ahead and print that out and keep it. And if you are ever in question about have you turned something in on time, the due date for something, you know, shouldn't you have gotten something back from APA, anything like that, check the bulletin first. And if you have any question remaining, call or email APA. You don't want to miss deadlines. It will kick you to the next time period entirely. They are very set in stone about their deadlines. Other sources. I mentioned the Chapter President's Council manual. It's available for most chapters. It is updated. It's about $20, I think. I would not right now call that a comprehensive source, though. It doesn't follow the APA outline of test content, so you're searching a little bit harder to figure out what you may still need to know. It's good information. It's pretty cheap, but I wouldn't call it a comprehensive source necessarily. PlanetaZen is a good source, a good comprehensive source. They have a course right now that is $120, I believe. It comes with practice exams. It comes with modules for you to work through. You can email in questions. You can join a forum to study with other people online. I definitely would call it a comprehensive source and just has a lot of different things going for it, essentially. And if I didn't mention the AICP Exam Prep 2.0, that I believe is $195. The PlanetaZen is $120. The PDC study notes are free. So absolutely go get the PDC study notes for free, and then you can make a decision about, you know, how you want to spend any additional money if you want to. StudyStack.com, you can get flashcards for that if you like to study that way. That's kind of neat. The OYES.org, I would only check that if you have a legal case where you're really confused over. I'd go check what they say about it, but otherwise it's not something you really have to access. Online forums, like I said, the PlanetaZen course includes that. The link to the planner site from the Colorado chapters website, she has an online forum there. I'm not sure how active it actually is. And then, you know, things you never know what's going to pop up. I got an email from somebody yesterday that PBS over Labor Day, and in some places I guess it actually will be Labor Day, they're going to have a one-hour special on Daniel Burnham. And so there's a different way to study for you. He's a person that you certainly need to know, and I think hopefully the special will, you know, talk about his place in planning and history of planning in that era. So that could be interesting. Obviously, I haven't seen it yet, but it's going to be playing on Labor Day, and I'm assuming repeating after that on various PBS stations. The practice exams, I know people love to use these, and I think they are good to get a feel for taking an online test and or taking computerized test and then taking, you know, these tiered questions and seeing that. Don't study the actual questions, though. I mean, nobody has APA's questions. But pay attention to the format, like the tiered structure, and pay attention to the topic. If there's a topic on one of these practice exams and you don't know what it's about, you know, you don't need to memorize that question. You need to go read about that topic and just get it in your head generally. This is the APA page for selected readings. The way I would use this is get one of the comprehensive sources, the PDC study notes, or the PlanetaZen course, or the AICP Exam Prep 2.0. Get one of those, look through it, figure out where your weak spots are, and then look at this list of selected readings to read up in your weak areas. I would say that the Everyday Ethics by Carol Barrett is a good source. It's an easy read. It actually reads just like a book, not like a textbook. So in that way, it's very good. There are some other options for ethics these days. However, it's not as bare as it used to be. The Practice of Local Government Planning or the Green Bible, I think that's definitely a source that private consultants who are taking this exam should look into. If you've worked in the public sector extensively, a fair amount of what the Green Bible covers is what you're doing every day, day in and day out. But if you have not been so involved with projects start to finish in the public participation process, I think you definitely need to look in the Green Bible and read up on those sources. Somebody asked me before after one of these prep sessions, well, what one thing do I need to go study? And I hate to tell you, there is no answer for that. There's not any one source you should go study. You need to get, I would say, one of the comprehensive sources, again, the APA 2.0, the PDC study notes, or the PlanetaZen course, and then fill in where you need to fill in. And then just general test tips, get plenty of rest. Like I said, you will likely be sitting in that room for almost 4 hours. Dress to be comfortable, eat before you go in, all that good stuff. Arrive early. You do not want to be rushed. Answer every question. There's no points off for, you know, getting something wrong as opposed to leaving it blank. So answer everything. The marking option, like I said before, when you go through and take this exam, you can mark a question. Whether you answer it or leave it blank, you can mark it. And then at any point in time, you can go back through and review the questions that you have marked. So you can use it As I was saying earlier, you can use it to mark all law questions and to double check between those. You can mark, you know, all law questions and the ones that you are questionable about and go back and check those. But it's a nice feature, and definitely use it, you know, in whatever form you want to, but I would definitely use it. Just a couple other generic things there. Think national and think APA. There are some things that are very state-specific occasionally. This is not a state-specific test. In Pennsylvania, the enabling legislation for planning is called the Pennsylvania Municipalities Planning Code. You will never see the words Municipalities Planning Code in terms of the Pennsylvania MPC on this exam. You may see them ask about a progressive state or something like that, but it's really not state-specific in general. And then just thinking national and think APA in terms of, you know, this is APA's test. You know, they're trying to encourage good planning. They want the best answer for a question. They don't want the answer that, well, it's okay to do it this way. They want the answer for, this is the way APA thinks planning should be done, the best planning out there. So think in terms of that as well. And I'm going to pass it over now to Chris Bartleson to go over history, theory, and law, and we'll keep moving along.
Good afternoon. This is Chris Bartleson, going over a section that is only worth 15%, but because the pass margin is so slim, you don't want to miss these relatively easy questions, because as Susan illustrated earlier, a lot of the process and functional questions are very complicated. So you want to go through maybe one time and answer the ones that come to you easily and mark the more complicated ones. And hopefully, you'll be able to answer these quickly. I do agree that if there's any one book that you do read, it should be the practice of local government planning, which was first published in 1941 by Ladislaus Sego. And the second chapter of the second edition is excellent for historical background. Susan and my email will be shown at the end, and we can provide you with a PDF of that chapter to study. Now, the more current editions of the Green Bible are an easier read and, you know, easier to pick up things on. The forerunners in their category. Patrick Geddie, originally from Scotland, is known as the father of regional planning. He wrote Cities in Evolution and used the term conurbation, which is a growth of the urban area. Edward Bassett, known as the father of zoning. He headed a commission who wrote the first comprehensive zoning ordinance in the U.S., which was in New York City in 1916. He was also on a team appointed by President Hoover, who drew up the State Standard Zoning Enabling Act in 1924. That's something that you should commit to memory. The first State Standard Zoning Enabling Act in 1924. Daniel Burnham, which I'm sure many of you have already heard of and will be the subject of the PBS special, the father of city planning. He was a Chicago architect who supervised the largest construction of a World Expo in 1893. It was called the White City Exhibit. He also prepared the 1909 plan for Chicago, which was the first large-scale plan of a metro area that was followed very well, really put into law and followed and constructed. His most famous statement is, "Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood, and probably themselves will not be realized." Ian McCarg, the father of modern ecology, he wrote Design with Nature in 1969. That's another notable date and volume to remember. Design with Nature in 1969. Lawrence Thaler, the father of the modern housing code. He was a leading reformer behind adoption of the New York State Tenement Housing Law in 1901. And Paul Davidoff, father of advocacy planning. He founded the Suburban Action Institute in 1969. And he developed the concept of advocacy planning, where planners get in the shoes of those less fortunate in our society and advocate on their behalf. All right, we already talked about Patrick Getty, the father of regional planning. One of his disciples was Lewis Mumford. Lewis Mumford helped found the Regional Planning Association of America in 1923. This was in the New York City region. I'm going to skip to Clarence Perry. Actually, he wrote the Regional Survey of New York and its Environs in 1929, and I will say, I guess there was a little bit of antagonism between Perry and Mumford at the time. Like I said, different planning views, but Clarence Perry should be remembered as putting into practice the neighborhood unit concept. Clarence Stein helped lay out the Garden City of Radburn in New Jersey. Again, we mentioned Lawrence Thaler. And Catherine Bauer is also a very important name to remember as an advocate for the lower class living in the tenements of New York City. Paul Davidoff, again, father of advocacy planning. Saul Alinsky and Sherry Ornstein are often mentioned in those terms. Somebody I don't have written down but is also very important is Norm Krumholtz. Norm Krumholtz headed the planning department in Cleveland, and he put an emphasis on social equity in the whole department. Lincoln Steffens was a notable muckraker, exposing corruption and poor living conditions of people. Upton Sinclair, the author of The Jungle, is also considered as a muckraker, as well as Jacob Riis, who wrote How the Other Half Lives and Children of the Poor. It really brought, shone a spotlight on the poor, poor living conditions in the city. Edward Bassett, again, is the father of zoning. Frank Lloyd Wright, a very famous architect. Actually, the AIA voted him as one of the most, well, actually, the most influential architects in the U.S. George Pullman. His claim to fame, besides inventing the Pullman car for the rail lines, he established a model industrial town for his employees. Joseph Hudnut was an architect and he advocated for modern architecture in the Bauhaus style. And he wrote Architecture in the Spirit of Man. Lawrence Haworth wrote The Good City in 1963, which was an attempt to formulate a systematic philosophy of the city. No discussion of planning would be complete without Robert Moses and Jay of 20th century New York City. And he's often compared to Baron Haussmann, who redeveloped France. Where he got in trouble with Jane Jacobs is that he demolished many parts of the Bronx and built a car city. Jane Jacobs, of course, is known for writing The Death and Life of Great American Cities. William White, what he is best known for is coining the term suburban sprawl. And he wrote The Organizational Man in 1956. T.J. Kent wrote The Urban General Plan in 1964, and actually T.J. Kent was an intern of Lewis Mumford's. Frederick Law Olmsted Sr. is a very, of course, important name. I'm sure you've heard of by now. Actually, he can be considered as the founder of American landscape architecture, and he is the nation's number one park maker. He designed Central Park from 1858 through 1876. Also, he is one of the founding members of the City Beautiful movement. His son, F.L. Olmsted Jr., actually was the first president of the American City Planning Institute in 1917. He developed some towns some garden city towns in the U.S. were designed by him, One of the most famous was Forest Hill Gardens in Queens. Pierre L'Enfant is the master developer of Washington, D.C. The plan for Washington, D.C. was based on the palace and gardens of Versailles, and the plan for Washington, D.C. was developed between 1790 and 1791. Now, my slide shows Benjamin Boniker as having recreated the plan in a couple days. There has been some talk lately about, you know, history is slippery. History changes from time to time. So just the thing to remember here is he was an African-American surveyor who was very involved with the project. But also, please write down another name. Andrew Ellicott also was very involved in the plan for Washington, D.C. So, you know, at this point, I'd say there's not going to be a specific question about how Benjamin Boniker was involved with the plan, but just know he was involved. Baron Houseman, like I mentioned earlier, was the master planner of the redevelopment of Paris in the mid-1980s. He rebuilt it completely. He put in a new water supply, sewers, bridges, public buildings, wide boulevards. So he was quite influential on plans that happened across the Atlantic in the U.S. also. Alfred Bettman is a very important figure. Bettman is credited with saving zoning in the Euclid case, which we'll talk about later. He was a lawyer from Cincinnati who crafted an Ohio bill that created a Citizens Planning Commission. He served on Hoover's committee to develop the Standard Zoning Enabling Act and the Standard Planning Enabling Act. He was the first president of the American Society of Planning Officials. Rachel Carson. It's actually, I would say, in a tie with Ian McCarg as far as ecology. She woke up the nation to the detrimental effects of DDT on wildlife and people, of course. She wrote a book called Silent Springs in 1962. Very important. Kevin Lynch wrote Image of the City in 1960. It was all about people's perception. He brought about modernist architecture, and I think a lot of the resulting architecture was kind of boxy and not very aesthetic, but he's a very important person who did influence architecture. James Wilson Rausch was actually a very important developer. He helped to build the new city of Columbia, Maryland, and he helped to popularize the term of urban renewal. William Levitt. I think the suburbs could not be mentioned without bringing him into the dialogue. Levittown was made to help provide housing for all the vets returning from World War II. He actually managed to produce 32 bedroom houses a day on Long Island, in a place called Levittown. Andre Dewani, very influential persona in today's TND movement. I'm sure you've heard about Seaside, Florida, Gaithersburg, Maryland. He wrote Suburban Nation, very important contemporary person. Peter Calthorpe is very similar in his achievements with Andre Dewani. Joel Garreau, remember that he wrote the Edge City book in 1991. And Richard Florida also is a contemporary of Peter Calthorpe and Andre Dewani. What time is it? All right, agrarian philosophy. A lot of this I don't want to go into in detail. It's all in that chapter 2 of the second edition of the Green Bible. So everything on this slide is detailed in that book. The only thing I can say about agrarian philosophy, it did detract from city planning at that time. So you had a lot of romanticism of agrarianism at that time. It took a lot of attention away from city planning as an end result because of speculation and a huge increase in immigration. The grid city, the grid pattern, ended up being pretty much the way that Detroit, New York, a lot of the big cities got developed at the time. Of course, and then laissez-faire helped with the hands-off attitude of local government. Public health movement, of course, due to the extreme density and unsanitary conditions in the tenements. Garden City movement, City Beautiful. There's a lot of information in that chapter. Again, the City Functional that followed the publication of the first Green Bible in the 1940s. Know Your New Towns during the Depression in the 30s. Roosevelt had his administration create some new towns called Greenbelt Cities. Okay, so the AICP board this year called out a separate category, Patterns of Human Settlement. Basically, it's of course history, but more on a geographical scale. So, of course, city planning can go back as far as Greece. So Hippodamus drew up the first grid city pattern. We have Law of the Indies. Actually, I want to correct the slide a little bit. Law of the Indies came from Spanish rule in this New World. It was signed in, adopted in 1573. And the Law of the Indies is often seen as the first wide-ranging guideline toward design and development of communities. This contained 148 rules. Places in the U.S. where this was applied was Tucson, Arizona, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the Presidio military complex in San Francisco. Now, it's true that Savannah is also laid out in a town square. It was developed in 1733 by James Oglethorpe. I think that was one of the questions on my test. The Ordinance of 1785, that is very important. Again, it'll be on your history timeline that you should print out and carry with you to study whenever you can. You know, Ernest Burgess, with the concentric zone, that's more or less like a bullseye. If you look at a dartboard, a bullseye, you're going out in concentric rings with your development spreading ever outward. The sector model is that cities grow in varying speeds and varying magnitude in different sections of the city. Kristaller, one little thing to maybe help remember this guy is he put this theory, central place theory, to work when he was a member of the Nazi Party and he was planning the invasion of Poland. So maybe that'll help with that one. The last two are more or less suburban kind of models of expansion. I put a website on the bottom. I highly recommend printing out this article, which was included in the Journal of the APA. Explains sitar, remember sitar, explains this very well. But we go from the top, from synoptic rationality down to radical. It goes from impersonal on the top to a more personal attitude on the bottom. Synoptic rationality is pretty much what goes on. You make your goals and you go ahead and plan towards achieving your goals. And then incrementalism has also been called muddling along. Because we know that we make decisions and then, you know, other decisions get made and you kind of muddle along and go through with making decisions. Advocacy, of course, and again, everything is in that article if you want to print that one out. Okay, now we're going to get into the law section. Of course, the amendments, you have to know just blindly. I also want to mention that there are two cases that involve the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery and created equality regardless of race and creed. The 5th Amendment concerns takings. The 14th is due process. And, you know, we all know what the First Amendment is, freedom of religion and speech. First case is Mugler versus Kansas, and this was a due process case which said that Kansas could prohibit sale of alcohol. And I'm not going to read, you know, I'm not going to insult your intelligence. You can all read these slides. I'm going to go ahead and maybe focus on some that warrant more attention. The different height limits under Swayze, of course. Different height limits. Okay, that was the beginning of being able to zone for different uses, heights, whatever. How to check. Okay, I'm going to skip to Village of Euclid versus Ambler. This is seen as the Rosetta Stone, if you will, of zoning because it upheld separation of uses. Again, you will note this was argued by Alfred Bettman, the father of zoning. Burr members, Parker. The 1968 Jones versus Mayer. Discrimination in selling houses was not permitted. What you want to make a note of here is that it prohibited redlining. And I know that the term redlining was used in my test. Redlining is where real estate agents would draw a red line around areas and would not show houses to anybody but white people. So that act was prohibited with Jones versus Mayer. One of the first growth management cases is Golden versus Ramapo. This is a very important one to remember. Adequate facilities must be provided before additional building can occur. The 1973 case of Fasano versus Oregon, that is a case that did not make it to the Supreme Court, but it said that zoning must be consistent with the comp plan. South Burlington versus Laurel, Mount Laurel is what this is mainly known as, Mount Laurel. If any area is expanding, you must provide a fair share of low and moderate income housing. The other growth management case that's very important is Petaluma. Hill versus Gautreaux is another civil rights case. It said that public housing could not be concentrated in one place. It must be scattered. Scattered site housing. Home Builders versus Livermore. I underline more because you can remember more with moratorium. It established the use of moratoria. This is another growth management case. I'm going to skip to Penn Central versus New York City. This case is just called Penn Central. This is a very important case. They said it was not a taking that an addition could be put on Grand Central Station because you could use TDR, Transfer of Development. Right. So I would say Aikens versus Tiburon is one of Susan's questions alluded to earlier. There is a takings when it deprives property of all economically viable use and when it fails to enhance a legitimate government interest. I think in this case it's really important to stress that that the city was upheld because they had a very thorough comp plan. Did I go on too far? Central Hudson, please. Okay, so the second Mount Laurel case was in 1983. The first Mount Laurel just, it wasn't clear. They still had lingering questions, so it came back to the Supreme Court, and, you know, they more or less said, yes, Mount Laurel 1 holds, but they established a special three-judge panel to rule on exclusionary zoning cases that came up. Okay. First English is another very important case. Said that temporary takings are still takings. Okay. I always had a hard time remembering the Nolan and the Dolan cases. The Nolan, try to remember that with the nexus. The Nolan established the essential nexus takings test, where if a government was going to ask an applicant to do something, there had to be a nexus of the outcome for the public. And there was no relationship between what was being asked for in the permit versus what the government wanted, so there was no relationship. So that one was a rule for Nolan. Lucas is another takings case that's very important. Dolan, of course. It went on from the essential nexus in Nolan, and it went to a rough proportionality test. Lingle versus Chevron, and skip over that one. Kelo, you may have heard about the Kelo case. It relied very heavily on the Penn Central case. And, no, not Penn Central. I'm sorry. It referred back on the Berman versus Parker case. As long as you had a comp plan, you had a redevelopment plan, it was legal to go ahead and take private property to carry out your redevelopment plans. So the court did rule for the City of New London on that one. And then there's another case in 2005 you might want to look over. This is the kind of question you may see on the test. This is where you have to know your cases and answer these quickly so you can go back and spend a lot more time on the more complicated questions. And the answer is 1, 3, and 4. So that would be number or letter D. We're going to follow up with some facts that look more or less random, but had a very important the Erie Canal, it changed everything in the Midwest. It increased the population of the Midwest due to the opening of the canal and the shipment from New York City. The Union Pacific was carried on, was built and completed, but it was built during the Civil War, so that was a pretty awesome thing that was carried out. First city with a subway was Boston, and I might add the first city with a functioning electric trolley was Richmond, Virginia. You see all the other facts there. What I do want to stress, you will see a question concerning either 1 acre or 1 mile. And those are 2 figures that you have to have committed to memory. I think that pretty much finishes up this section for now, and I will turn it back over to Susan.
Okay, I'm going to get started with plan making. I just want to reiterate for people, if you're having any sort of audio problems, I would call the technical helpline for that, 1-800-263-6317. Plan making, as you can probably imagine, this is really what we do day in, day out for the most part as planners. And this is really where they're going to get into the process questions, the approach questions. And if you start, looking at the outline of materials, plan making, and then functional, and then spatial, and public participation, they really start running together, they really start overlapping, and those areas together make up 80% of the exam. So you can imagine there's going to be a lot of process going on, a lot of approach type questions, and just really when you're studying, try and think through things with that type of question in mind. This long list of items here is from the APA outline of test content. So if it looks familiar, it should. That's what that is. Today, topic areas and give you everything you need to know. So we're going to give you a broad background of things. We're going to go into detail on a couple of items. And some things, and this is like I was talking about with the overlap, some things really, they keep coming up over and over again. Natural and built environment and land use and development regulations, for example, I'm going to discuss those a little bit under the functional topics because they're also under there, but I'm not going to discuss them so much under plan making. Okay, down in your head and think through it in terms of different types of context. Consider how you would go through this process for a transportation project. Consider how you would go through this process for an environmental project. Consider how you would go through this process for a state agency versus the local government. And work through some scenarios in your head with these different topics and just get this down because you just have to know this and how it really works. Not necessarily have these 7 or 8 steps perfectly memorized and everything known, but you have to understand it and be able to work through it in your head. Goal setting is pretty straightforward. It's where the community wants to go. It's very important. It's very important for court cases in particular. You know, the courts will go back and look in a comprehensive plan to support actions that a community has taken, and that's something to keep in mind. Even the case law expects, or even the courts, as you work through things, they expect that a community has identified their goals and where they want to go. These definitions, these are kind of the national average definitions of these things. Sometimes, communities vary in how they define these precisely and how they carry them out. This is kind of the generic version of them, I would say. Just be familiar with them and what a goal is versus an objective versus a policy versus a program. So, as I said, comprehensive plans are the official statement. They're adopted. They always contain certain things definitely there. They may have additional things. Some communities these days are definitely adding sustainability components, you know, or something addressing energy, things like that. But you're always going to see demographics, land use, transportation, community facilities, and infrastructure. Visioning can be part of a comprehensive plan or can be done for different types of plans. Those bullet points there, I just want to call out the computer simulation. That can be really critical for visualization purposes, especially working with the public. If you have the public in on a visioning process, you know, it really can be helpful for them to see something happening. Something along those lines there where, you know, you've taken the existing landscape and you've shown how housing could be laid out on it. That can definitely help the public. The next few items, the designs, charrette, and facilitated meetings, the Delphi method and task force, those are different ways that you can carry out visioning. And the inclusionary, you just need to be inclusionary in a visioning process. If you are not involving everybody from the very start, when you get to the end, you're going to have problems. And the note across the bottom, what I want to get across with that is a lot of times when people think about visioning, particularly with design charrettes, sometimes you know, you automatically think of the great plans that are going to come out of it and the pretty pictures and how wonderful everything could be. But a visioning process will take into account some of the less pretty things, so the obstacles that have to be overcome, and, you know, it's got to cover infrastructure, environment, economic opportunity. You know, even if those aren't exciting topics, they've got to be covered for the visioning process to be effective. This is probably the boringest slide in the world to me, personally, anyway. but these are different ways of organizing, analyzing, and reporting data. And you just need to know these different forms and maybe a couple others that you might come across in more detailed study notes. And just know the names, know when it's appropriate to use these different types of charts and flow charts and things like that. Demographics, I am going to go into this in a little bit more detail just to give you an idea of, you know, in each one of these topics under plan making, you need to get down to a certain level of detail. For this one, I'm going to go down into a level of detail to show you that. So demographics, fertility, mortality, migration, those are the basis for population analysis. Those are things that you need to be familiar with. That's what a demographer is really worried about in terms of population work anyway. And they take that information and then all the other information they can gather on you know, income, jobs, that type of thing, and they do lots of things with it. And you need to know the different way that they're going to be describing things. If anything on the slide is not familiar to you, you need to go out and learn it. I'm not going to go into this very much at all. You can find this in any good basic planning book, and you can also just find it on Wikipedia, you know, kurtosis is about is on Wikipedia. So you can find this information pretty readily, but you definitely need to know it. You need to understand how to interpret it. And when talking about statistics, you need to know those things because you need to understand if the data that's coming into you is quality data, for starters, and then, you know, what you can do with it and are the analysis and the conclusions that are coming out are good. Some generic things, descriptive trends and projections, I think those are pretty straightforward. A comprehensive plan would use all those different things in order to accurately discuss a community, you know, where it is, how it's changed over time, and where it's going in the future. Again, a few more definitions of things. And again, these are kind of the generic national interpretation of them. They're mostly straightforward. The one thing I do want to, two things I want to call out, estimates. Just to give you an example, you know, people estimate because, not because they want to estimate necessarily, but because they don't have enough time, money, or people to go out and do a count of something. So they estimate based on some other piece of known information. Like a driver's license, you know, if you're doing some type of analysis, you can go and just request, you know, the state already knows how many drivers there are. You know, you don't have to go count them. You go use their data. And then you can make some estimates off of that on various things. Regarding a forecast, the big difference between a forecast versus a projection is the very last line there. Forecasts reflect and incorporate the decisions and judgment of an analyst with respect to various factors. An example of this would be someone taking a population projection and adjusting it because they're aware of some changes in a zoning ordinance that's going to increase or decrease housing density in an area in the future. So that's an example of how a forecast is different from a projection. Population projections, again, you take that information on the three components of demography, fertility, mortality, and migration. And you can do a variety of different projections with them for population or a variety of different techniques. Right now, the cohort component is typically what you will see in most things. It's doing age groups and then accounting for fertility, mortality, and migration. You can also use housing units to figure out population projections. Definitely, I would understand how the cohort component functions, so that if you had a question about that, you could make sense of that. This is just to show you a couple of pyramids. And if you look at these and that means nothing to you, then you need to look into this a little bit more. The top one is the U.S., and it's showing you out. The left side is male and the right side is female. The top one is the United States. The bottom one is Bangladesh. I think Bangladesh in the bottom is 2000 and the United States in the top is 2050. And essentially, when you look at the United States on the top, you should be seeing that as an even population, stable population. People have long lifespans on that top pyramid. The bottom pyramid, when you look at that, you should be realizing that's a very young population. It's a growing population, but people have shorter lifespans. Something else that you will see at times is a very lopsided pyramid, where in most cases the male side is much longer out to the side than the female side, and that can happen in a community where there's a prison population or something like that. That can get you really lopsided off to the side. But there's several different pyramids, and they're telling you kind of a general thing, and you need to just understand the general interpretation of them. And why these matter, of course, recently with the census underway, the count, which I think was official April of this year, was like the count day. These numbers are used to allocate funding. Numbers mean money. That's one of the reasons why there was such a big push that you might have noticed, you know, turn in your census form, make sure that you're counted. Urban areas in particular, we're trying to get the word out. You know, we want people to be counted because it impacts the funding that they get to offer services to their citizens. Definitely check the U.S. Census Bureau website. Understand basically how the census works in the U.S. Look for information on past trends, historic shifts of things, any just notable data in, you know, one-time notable data. One of the things that, you know, just as an example of that, you know, the geographic or the population center of the United States has been shifting south and west for decades now, as generally there's been migration to the south and out west, and so that's a trend and also a point in time. Right now, I don't know what it is, but there's a population center to the United States, and that's something that you could find on the census website. And there will be nothing brand new on the test about the census. All the questions that are on this exam have gone through the process I described at the beginning, where APA develops the question, they roll it out one test cycle and have it as a sample question for people to answer. Then they look at how people answered it, and if, you know, approximately, you know, the 65% of people were getting it right. You know, if they throw out a question out there and, you know, 65% of people got it wrong, they realize the question isn't good and it's not going to make it through. But so by the time they get through that process, there's no question on the exam that was developed, you know, in less than a year's time. So when thinking about census information, you don't need to know any results at all from the census that was 2 months ago. Oh, budgets and financing. Some planners, you know, get away with ignoring this quite a bit in their career, and some people don't. But budgets are what turn plans into reality, and so planners need to be familiar with how they work. In particular, revenue is something that planners have to pay attention to, because they need to be, if they have a new plan and they want to put it into place, how are they paying for that? You know, what revenue source is going to fund that? And so this is a slide of various public financing tools, you know, taking things from the general funds, bonds, special taxing authorities. Definitely, I think the ones that are most applicable to planners are the last three, the user fees, the impact fees, and tax increment financing. Those are things that are really specific to planners. So know those, know when they come into play and how they can be used. And related to that, capital improvement budgets. These are for significant investments that have a long-term lifespan. You know, your transportation system, your sewer and water infrastructure, stormwater facilities, you know, those are going to be in place for decades. That's why they're capital improvement items. That's why typically bonds are banned. Economic based theory. This is something I'm going to go into a little bit more detail again to show you how some of this works. Basically, you're using data that they've collected in some form or another to tell you something about a region's economy and its industry. So, going through this process will divide an industry into one of two things, an export sector or a local sector, also referred to as basic or non-basic. So the export or the basic sectors, those are the industries that drive a region's economy. They have multiplier effects through the region, through the economy. And planners need to know which industries are those base or export sectors, so they know what's driving their region's economy. It can be fairly simple. Can be fairly simple to work through, and an indirect method of working on it is the location quotient method. That's currently the most popular method, and so we're going to work through that a little bit. And the Green Bible also has more detail on this if you want another source to read through. So the location quotient. There's the definition there officially for you. You're looking at the concentration of a given industry in a given place in comparison to the nation. This is usually done with employment data. You can also do it with output or income or other things like that, but employment data is pretty easy to find, so that's typically what people use. So you're looking at local employment in a specific industry in comparison to your total local employment, and then you're comparing that to the national employment in that specific industry versus the total national employment. And, of course, you're assuming that the base year for those comparison numbers is identical. And when you work that employment data or whatever else you're using, when you work it through that equation, you're going to come up with something that's, you know, in the range of zero and up typically. I've never seen anything higher than five in my basic research. But if it's under one, it's basic. And if it's over one, it's considered non-basic. Did I say that right? Well, the slide is correct anyway. If the location quotient is greater than one, you're exporting employment, or it's basic. If it's under one, it's importing, or it's local, or it's non-basic, whichever term you want to think of it in terms of. I like this slide better. To me, this helps clear it up quite a bit, I have to say. This is Minnesota in 2000, and it's showing you some of the industries in Minnesota. And if you track the numbers upward, one is there. And there's only a couple things that are under one. The furniture and fixtures, I think, and business services. So basically, those are very local industries in Minnesota. Those are not driving anything at all. There's several things that are just getting over one. The high technology and health services. So they're important, but they're not really driving things all that much. Obviously, medical devices down at the very bottom, that's up to 3.5. Obviously, that is a huge generator in the state of Minnesota in 2000. And then the ones, industrial equipment, food, printing, paper, those are obviously also critical. So you can take that piece of information, the basic sector activity, and you can get a base multiplier to really come up with, you know, what the impact is. So if you get an economic base multiplier of 3 for an industry, that means that for one job, you're getting 3 jobs elsewhere from that industry. So it really is a driving influence in the region. Shift share analysis is an economic analysis as well, but it is separate from the economic base information. It's an interesting way to look at things. If there's growth or retraction, I guess, really, in an area, where is it coming from? Is it coming from national economy and things that are going on? Is it coming from a particular industry and just things in that industry happening, or are there unique local factors that are going on? So, you know, residential construction right now and the way that's going, that is really national, and it's also specific to that industry. There's a national problem with construction, but it's also construction is faring much worse than some other areas. But residential construction, that particular industry is doing very badly right now. Transportation construction is not. So, you know, that's a difference between those two industries versus what's going on nationally. GIS, I'm not going to go into that very much at all. Just know how it can be used, how it's useful, particularly, you know, for public participation, display, interpretation. You need to know the basics of how it can be used. You don't need to know how to sit down at the computer and make a GIS map for this test. MIS is, I think, less known and understood. Basically, it's a system where you're trying to get things to work better. And an example that I can give you of this, when you have different departments working on things and they're perhaps not communicating and coordinating as well as they potentially could be, you can set up an MIS to make that more automatic and direct and streamlined. So if you have your planning department and they're working on residential developments, they know where that development is in the subdivision process. They don't necessarily know right away where it is in terms of getting septic systems permitted for it. They don't necessarily know if they have their permits through the conservation district for erosion and sedimentation control. So you can set up a computer system where everybody is inputting data on a project and that everybody can go in and easily check what's going on outside of their immediate area. And it just permits better coordination, better decision making for things. Functional areas. Again, this is a really long list, straight from the APA outline, however. This is a big part, again. Plan making is 30%, functional areas is 25%. So obviously that's a big chunk of the test, but if you look at all these different topics within here and you think, well, there's almost 20 things listed there and it's 25% of the test, you know, you could get one question on each of these. You could get three questions on one. There's not going to be 20 questions on transportation. You know, there's just not room in the test for something like that. So I would say in each topic area, you're going to get somewhere between maybe no question at all on your particular exam or maybe five questions. So keep that in mind when you're studying. You know, and across the bottom there, you want to know something about the history, the legislative background, the different terminology, the different implementation tools, and obviously how to plan for these different things. So again, when you're thinking about transportation, think of a transportation project start to finish. How does the public participation work? What are the steps? How are alternatives developed? Things like that you want to understand. Comprehensive planning versus policy planning. I'm not sure how they would ask a question about this, but since it's on the list, here's a little bit of information. The longer time frames that we would be talking about here for comprehensive planning would be 10 years or more, and the shorter time frames for policy planning would be, you know, more along the lines of 2 to 5 years. Community development. Keep in mind the different components of it. And again, as you work through trying to consider how APA would ask a question about this, keep in mind that there's economic aspects to this, there's social aspects to this, there's infrastructure aspects to this. Main Street models, go look at an example of a Main Street project and see how that worked. Housing and urban development, obviously. CDBG, which is Community Development Block Grants, federal funding that comes down and work their way to the local community. Grassroots, you know, you can get money from the federal government, but unless you have local knowledge and local people asking for something, advocating for something, and working on it, it's really not going to go very well. And we have noted here two APA policy guides related to community development. So, again, I noted this before, but these guides really lay out what APA's take is on an issue. For the test, you know, you're going to get a question. It's going to have four or five answers, and you need to answer the APA answer. If you are less familiar with a topic, make sure that you're reading any of the relevant APA policy guides because on the test and in planning in real life, you know, there are not necessarily right or wrong answers. There are better answers and there are worse answers. And for the test, you need to know what APA thinks is the best answer. So those guides can be very helpful in understanding what APA's position is on topics. Economic analyses and forecasts, I discussed this a fair amount under plan making. Here's just a couple other things to consider. You know, definitely question your data and look behind it and understand what's going on. We just got a demographic update for Pennsylvania, and it noted some township had the highest growth of any township in the entire state. And then on page 2, they explained that that was because there was a prison built. So it wasn't that that township really had this excellent growth. It was this odd anomaly thing. So make sure you, you know, look, in general at what the data is based on and what's going on. I talked a little bit about some of the economic base analyses. For these, you know, for the location quotient, also floor area ratio, you know, there is a need to do some basic math there, and you need to do that. APA is not going to ask you any really horrible math questions, but you will have to do some basic stuff. And definitely one of the things that you need to have straight are differences in terminology, because they can ask you, you know, what's more appropriate for somewhere. So you need to know what's a neighborhood shopping center versus a community shopping center versus a regional shopping center, and what does that really mean in trying to plan for those things. Economic development, there's not, you could go into this at a great level of detail, and we don't have time for that today. Definitely, though, one thing to make sure that you know and understand are the different implementation tools for economic development, business improvement districts, tax increment financing, business incubators. Look those up, understand those, know when a community would be using those type of tools to attract businesses and retain them, or to try and you know, do something with the workforce in terms of attracting a quality workforce and retaining them in your community. But those particular tools, I have to say, are much more about business attraction and retention. Energy policy, that is a big ticket item these days and has been for several years now, so it would certainly be included. Again, nothing in the last year is a question on an APA exam, but this has been an issue for a while now. There's a couple of policy guides on it. Keep in mind that there are national policies on it, but at the local level, things can be carried out or hindered. So understand how local government zoning ordinances could help or hinder alternative energies, for example. And just go through and consider the different implications of the different energy sources, the different infrastructure, transmission lines, pollution, wildlife impact. With the oil spill down in the Gulf, you know, people think of oil and they think of, obviously, air pollution after it's run through your car. But obviously, with oil, from the point of trying to extract it to the point of running it through a transmission line to the point of burning it in your car, there are impacts. And there are impacts like that with any talking about CO2 emissions from solar panels, but there are issues, in terms of impacting your neighbor and, you know, just different things like that, that would be fair game, I would say. Food system planning is another thing that's gotten bigger in the past 5 years or so. It used to be people always talked about agricultural land preservation, and we've shifted more these days into talking about preserving the agricultural industry, preserving, farming, family farms, buy fresh, buy local campaigns, ensuring that your health food is safe, which seems such a basic thing, but, I mean, you look at the egg recall that's been in the news the past couple of weeks, and, you know, food safety is an issue. You've got to plan for things, public health, you know, access to fresh foods, affordability, food supply. These are all components of food system planning, and I would be familiar with the basics of it. Growth management. This is what some people think of automatically when they think of planning is, you know, you're talking growth management and land use. And that's definitely a big part of what a lot of people do. When you think about this, again, think national, not too specific to your state. Although a state program that's been leading and kind of ahead of the curve, as I said before, would be fair game for questions. I think Maryland, Oregon, you know, have been talked about a fair amount. Maryland's being talked about right now a little bit more because they're reassessing, you know, they're on smart growth version number 3, I think, down in Maryland. But so leading state programs can definitely be called out. But otherwise, methodologies and techniques, you want to think broadly, you know, urban growth boundaries, setting infrastructure limits, things like that. Annexation and ETJ, which is extraterritorial jurisdiction. For Pennsylvania planners out there, you know, this is, you never really work with this. We don't do this in Pennsylvania, but other states do, and so make sure you know what you're talking about there. And other states, communities, incorporated towns can annex land, and they can plan for areas outside of their official boundaries through extraterritorial jurisdiction, however the state's set up, so be familiar with that. Impact fees, again, that's something Pennsylvania is not real big on that, but other places are much more so. So be familiar with how those work. I think the APA policy guide would be a really good source on that in terms of, you know, the national perspective on it rather than getting caught up in what a specific government has done with something. Hazard mitigation and disaster planning. You know, when APA throws this topic up there, they're talking about everything. You know, they're talking about something like 9/11. They're also talking about responding to blizzards or hurricanes or wildfires. I mean, they're not so worried about what specific thing has happened, but the planning aspect of it is, in advance, what are you as planners doing to prepare? What sort of a game plan are you laying out as your response? And then when something has passed and you're in the recovery mode, how does that work? How do your agencies work together? How do all of your different entities work together? And, again, I think the BP spill is a good example of, you know, it's not just agency coordination, actually. It's coordination between all these various entities. You have the Coast Guard down in the Gulf. You have NOAA down there. Obviously, you have the states. You have the local governments, the parishes in Louisiana. And you have BP as a very big player, as a corporation, they're a very big player. So you have a lot of different entities that need to be coordinating to prepare for and respond for these things, whether they're man-made or natural. You need to be thinking about the process and the chain of command. There is a Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000, and APA does have a policy guide on this that you can look at. Historic preservation, I think we cover this a little bit more later as well. One of the things to keep in mind is that there's federally legislated actions that are needed for projects with federal permits or federal funding. Local efforts are based much more on state enabling laws and local interest. So this varies greatly state to place. I will say that the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 did set up the State Historic Preservation Office. There is a State Historic Preservation Office, or should be, in every state, and it's enabled by the 1966 Act. but your local preservation efforts are going to come from what the state says they can do, and then, of course, what the local community wants to push for. There's lots of information on housing. I think right after land use, when people think of planning, they think of housing. New York City, if you run through the history of New York City with housing, you've seen a lot of the different things. You know, they responded to safety in New York City. You know, they worked on zoning before anybody else. Look up the history of New York City with regards to housing, and you'll hit on a lot of the things that you need to know. Obviously, there's a lot of federal involvement. There's direct legislation, and then there's also indirect, basically, taxing policies for mortgages. That's the way that the federal government can get involved with housing. State and local government rules regarding housing, ensuring that people have covered their fair share and they're accommodating growth, ensuring affordable housing is available. The rural slum phenomenon, that's something that gets talked about, more so in times like these, honestly. Slums are not an urban issue. They're an issue wherever there are people, and there are people out in the rural areas, and they are affected by economic times that are difficult as well as anyone else is. And you can see from this list here, APA has several policy guides that relate to housing, and I would definitely look into those if you're less familiar with this topic area. Infrastructure is a very broad category. I would keep in mind that this ties in closely with energy. Any kind of piping that you're talking about ties in with energy. Public water, public sewer, delivery of natural gas. Transportation is obviously a big topic, but notice that, it's like hidden among infrastructure within the functional areas of practice. Definitely think in terms of being multimodal with transportation, pedestrian movement, walkability, and things like that. Institutional facilities, talking about schools, prisons, and military installations, when you're thinking about any one of these things, just try and think broadly. With schools, obviously, kids are going there to get educated, but those schools are also providing employment. If you have a higher education facility, you're creating an educated workforce in an area, so that impacts workforce characteristics. There are various community benefits and drawbacks to each one of these things. For example, with higher education facilities, that educates the local workforce, and you're also going to have complaints about student housing. And specifically with regard to military installations, base closure and reuse, the BRAC process, I would just know a little bit about that. It's a pretty, when you think in terms of the AICP exam, you might get a question or two, absolute tops, I would say, on something this specific. But if you're in a military town, you know that this is a very big deal, that if you talk about closing a base or downsizing a base or moving people, additional people to a base. Labor force and employment, this ties back to the economic development. It ties back to, higher education. And skill sets and diversity are important. And communities are important, particularly with respect to workforce attraction and retention. If people are moving for a job, in better economic times anyway, they can be selective and they want to move somewhere that they like. So communities, keep that in mind. A little bit more about land use. Make sure that you know these different things. different types of zoning ordinances, basics on subdivision and land development ordinances, different types of exactions, again, impact fees, perhaps fees in lieu of, requiring dedication of land, things like that, and the different types of development, transit-oriented development, mixed use, leapfrog development, that type of thing. And there's the sustainability and the smart growth policy guides from APA go over a lot of this information. And there's just a ton of information that you can find on different types of development. A little bit more going back to natural resources. A lot of the legislation came out of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And as amended, these are still the things that we are operating under, permits and regulations from the federal level. These laws that were passed, you know, 40 years ago now. There's a lot of different types of natural resources. Obviously, you can't know everything about all of them, you know, ground, water, surface water, wetlands, forests, endangered species, floodplain areas. Does the planning differ all that much by resource type? Well, you know, run through in your mind a planning project regarding floodplains or regarding, you know, wetlands or something like that. Going back to that initial slide or one of the initial slides in plan making, the process can be very similar, but you might notice some differences here and there once you think through something in detail. And there are, again, a couple policy guides from APA on a couple of different resources anyway. Parks, recreation, and open space. You know, it has its own type of data collection and inventory that you can do. Different terminology as to how to categorize resources. One of the things, you know, when people talk about parks, recreation, and open space anymore, trying to get a full accounting of costs and benefits. You know, people, there's construction and maintenance cost. Benefits are harder to quantify, but it's being done a lot more these days in terms of public health and those types of benefits. And in terms of what the community's demographics call for, do you have a young population? You need a lot of active areas. Do you have an aging population that might want more trails, less ball fields? Those are the kind of things that you just have to be somewhat familiar with. For social and health services, there are a variety of programs and resources. If you want to read something more current to get an understanding of these type of things, you know, look at where some of the economic stimulus money went to, because it went to a fair amount of state and local social and health services. And how are the local governments spending that money? And there's a couple of different policy guides on this as well. And obviously, this is something that you can argue over until the end of time, considering how the health care bill argument went in Congress in the past year or so. It's not an easy topic to discuss. Urban design. We have listed there some of the major traditions in urban design. Definitely, you need to be familiar with those and the people who were advancing them and the general time frame of when they were advanced, the social aspects of urban design, which ties into new urbanism and trying to, you know, increase walkability and pedestrian movement and getting people out, you know, to visit the economic centers in their town and to get exercise while they're doing it. And, you know, it's all tying in together. And generally, you know, it is really critical to know the people and the places. And, you know, Chris hit on this earlier, but, you know, the Clarence Perry and his explanation of a neighborhood unit that came out of the 1929 regional plan for New York City and its environs, and And that's a perfect example of, you know, you need to know that piece of information. You need to know it for the history of it. You need to know it for the person of it. You need to know it for its impact in the urban design area of practice. And I'm going to turn things back over to Chris now.
Okay, our spatial areas of planning. Of course, this intersects very closely with the functional area. I'm not quite sure how they break down their percentages, but you know, roughly it's 15%, which overlays other categories. We have all of those levels. Whatever your job is, you might be employed at one certain level. You might work for the state. You need to become familiar, at least casually, with issues that are going on in all of these other levels. And again, this relates back to history. And John Muir said it best. When we do try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched up to everything else in the universe. So John Muir founded the Sierra Club more than 100 years ago. And it's still a very important name in society. Of course, at the national level, the highway interstate system, which was developed by Dwight Eisenhower, started in the 1950s, and actually, as of this time, all federal interstates see a decrease in federal funding of projects. There are very many multi-state or bi-state planning projects going on. One, of course, going over state boundaries is the TVA. And this is a question that would be very easy to miss because A and B are true. It was created by the federal government to stop flooding and to create power. But what you have to look at is the question. You have to key in on a phrase, a certain phrase, and it says, what is the chief importance of the TVA? And it was C, the earliest example of federal legislation of U.S. planning. More multi-state or bi-state regions. Of course, we have the Hoover Dam. Of course, you can read the different elements there. One thing that's important to me is the very deleterious environmental effects that it had, is still having, because the water is released from the bottom. It's changed the Colorado River from a warm to a cold water river, and pretty much made all the native species become extinct. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the Port Authority, they're actually in charge of the rebuilding of the Twin Towers also. They weren't created to be a planning agency per se, but they are overseeing that project, and that is being delayed. You should be somewhat familiar with Dillon's rule. Basically, Dillon's rule says that any authority that municipalities have devolve from the state. So you have specific regulations that you can enforce, but if the state does not say you can do something, you do not have that power to enforce that law. As Susan mentioned earlier, be aware of states that have a state planning law, like Maryland, Florida, Tennessee. Hawaii was the first state with a statewide planning law. Planning for a sub-state region. Both Susan and I worked for a time in North Carolina, so we have a soft spot for planning down there. But as she mentioned, the ETJ planning applies to North Carolina. North Carolina also has the Outer Banks. They've had some devastating hurricanes, and the bay inside the Outer Banks has really been devastated on several occasions. North Carolina has a Coastal Zone Management Act, and actually California and several other coastal states have a CZMA. You have the Olmsted Parkway, actually, in Louisville, Kentucky. He drew up a green necklace around Louisville made up of roughly 7 to 8 individual parks tied together by parkways. So if you ever get to Louisville, I recommend that. And, of course, in the sub-state region category are MPOs, which many of you are familiar with, plans transportation for regions that might encompass 2 up to 8 counties. Also, there's RPOs, rural planning organizations. Of course, we know much planning goes on at county levels also. Planning for urban areas. With infill and redevelopment, plans have to be very sensitive so that the infill fits into the surrounding area. Redevelopment, the same thing. Transit-oriented development is very critical for urban areas that are incorporating light rail or public transit. TODs are very important to also develop at the same time you're putting in that transportation infrastructure. Peter Calthorpe was an individual very influential in bringing TOD into planning. Of course, traffic management is always an issue with cities. Homelessness, urban gardening, any issue that you see, any matter that you see brought up in planning, the planning magazine, is very important to focus on. One issue last year of the planning magazine had pretty much 80% of the articles devoted to urban gardening. Another urban issue, actually, which applies to Rust Belt areas in particular, are declining populations. In cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and Buffalo, they're having to plan for an orderly shrinkage. For example, in our most recent planning magazine, there was an article about Detroit having to demolish 3,000 buildings by the end of the year because they are vacant, the population has declined precipitously, and they're demolishing 3,000 dilapidated vacant structures this year and 7,000 more by 2013. So that's just an issue out there. Planning for suburban areas. Of course, it's all there. The gardening issue very much applies to suburban areas with their large lawns that are very capable of supplying food. Small town planning, the TOD also applies. I know New Jersey has a program that they're trying to develop TODs in conjunction with light rail. Planning for rural areas. Susan mentioned slums earlier, rural slums. Well, homelessness is also an issue in rural areas. Again, that was mentioned in a planning issue last year. There's a lot of ag preservation, and we have to keep in mind that the rural areas are largely responsible for providing regional recreation resources. There is also a policy guide on homelessness. Okay, again we see Clarence Perry. I think for the third time we've seen his name issued in regard to the neighborhood unit concept. Neighborhoods are defined very much by history and culture. Neighborhoods all need services, and walkability is a very important issue. The 1969 Symposium on Neighborhood Collaborative Planning is an important thing to read up on. Okay, downtowns have the bids and the TIFs, traffic. Making sure you have a mix of use downtown is just, I can't stress the importance, because you need a population of residents to be there to support your businesses so that you don't have a lot of traffic. Everybody's got to drive in. You have to create more parking. People have to drive in for everything. So you also need a residence around your downtown. You'll see corridors mentioned. Of course, transportation is your most prevalent type of corridor. And again, there is a policy guide on surface transportation that was just adopted in April of this year. Multimodal is the focus. All types of transportation modes. There's a picture of the Greenway that we're getting under in South Bethlehem. This greenway, or any greenway wherever, is important, of course, for recreation, socialization, tourism, and, of course, transportation also. Waterfronts, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Kentucky, Pittsburgh. There's lots of towns that have revitalized their waterfronts, and it provides tremendous economic opportunity for tourism. Places such as Pier 39 and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area in San Francisco are excellent examples of waterfronts. Historic districts are something that you should be aware of, especially the COA, the Certificate of Appropriateness. Having lived in a historical district before, and of course Bethlehem has several historic districts, it's actually a pretty important part of planning knowledge for those places. Certificate of appropriatenesses are necessary whenever there is an exterior change to the structure. And you have a HARB that goes along with that, Historic Architectural Review Board. They're the ones who hear and provide the certificates. Of course, your National Register of Historic Places, which was created, as Susan said, back in 1966, is actually under the authority of the National Park Service. Of course, as I mentioned, these categories cross boundaries. You can't really separate one from the other. All right. That covers that topic. Pass it over to Susan.
Okay, I'm going to get into public participation and social justice, which makes up 10% of the exam, approximately. These are, again, the APA test content areas. And I'm going to go into each one of those a little bit more. So why does it matter? I would say as the very general answer to that it matters because if you don't have public participation in a process, you're not going to create a lasting solution that has support. You're going to get to the end. You're going to have to start things over again. That's not efficient. So basically, you know, the one answer is that it just makes sense to do it because you'll get a lasting solution and the most efficient process you can. And, you know, you just ought to be doing it is another answer. And then, of course, the AICP Code of Ethics requires that you do it. And one thing to keep in mind, and I picked this up from somebody else, I have to admit, I don't know who it was now, but I'd like to pass it on. The melting pot idea versus the salad bowl idea. And what is the American public, you know, in school, talking about U.S. history, people are told, oh, the U.S. is a melting pot and everybody came over and we all went together and we're all the same now. Versus the theory that, you know, yeah, we have a lot of different things in the U.S. We have a lot of different cultures, people from a lot of different countries, you know, continuing to come in, people who have been here hundreds of years and still affiliate, you know, with their ancestry, you know, we're more of a salad bowl perhaps than a melting pot. And, you know, you really need to tailor the public participation for your project to the community that you're in, and make sure that you are reaching out to everyone and giving them an opportunity to take part in a process that's going to impact them. A couple of different names. I don't think we've hit on these too much. I believe one of the questions at the beginning went over them, but Saul Alinsky worked on community organizing, specifically the stockyards back in the 1930s, what were referred to as the back of the yards neighborhoods. He wrote a book that was published in 1971 called Rules for Radicals, and essentially he was telling people, you know, you've got to stand up. You've got to have a voice. You've got to make your presence heard. This is how you go about doing that, you know, instead of just essentially just taking what was put upon you. The 1964 Economic Opportunity Act, that was part of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, his Great Society. It was a major piece of federal legislation that addressed social justice, and I would say it was likely really the first major one that did that, and probably was one of the most far-reaching still to this day. And the Head Start program remains, and that was put in place by that 1964 Economic Opportunity Act. Paul Davidoff, he, another advocacy planner, worked basically through the 1950s to the 1980s. You'll see his name just in terms of advocacy planning, and he really took the position that it was okay for planners to be advocates of things. As a matter of fact, planners should be advocates for things. We were not just technical process people that data led to the right answer. You know, we needed to decide what was best and advocate for that position. And Cherry Arnstein was not a planner at all, if I remember properly. I believe she was a medical doctor, but obviously did a variety of things in her life. And one of the things she came up with was the ladder of citizen participation from 1969. That's shown over on the right, and it's a little hard to see, but basically the ladder at the bottom, non-participation. Tokenism and from the tokenism stage of the ladder where you consult or you inform the public, but you're not actually giving them the decision-making power. The top of the ladder is citizen control. Directly below that is delegated power. Below that is partnership. All three of those are considered citizen power in her ladder. The goal is to be as high up that ladder as possible with public participation. Generally, time and money constraints, and to some extent, just the interest of the public put public participation further down, more in the range of the tokenism. But she was advocating for, you know, really something should be up as high as possible on that ladder. Planning the participation process, you know, you not only have to, you know, do your plan for whatever your resource or issue is. You know, if you're trying to improve walkability in an urban neighborhood, working on a roadway transportation project, land development, you know, whatever it is, in addition to planning that, you need to be planning your participation process. Who you need to get involved with things, who really is the decision maker. What decision actually are you asking people to make? What different stages are you going to go through? What different techniques are you going to use to best draw out the public and get them involved? What sort of schedule are you going to go through? And then, you know, as with anything, is it working? Are you getting people out? Maybe you need to go back through. Maybe you missed someone. Maybe you missed a technique that you should have been using. But this is a basic outline of steps that can be used in any type of project. And your goal, particularly with underserved groups, is really to get the most appropriate outreach method and put it out there. And if it takes a few different things, you know, that's what you need to be doing is a few different things. Public hearings are one public participation technique, very technical. You get a transcript. Typically, however, you're at the end of the process and you're sort of documenting something with a public hearing, or maybe you're documenting official feedback when you've gotten down to a limited number of alternatives or something like that. open houses where you're just putting the information out there for people and getting their feedback. Those are typically a little bit earlier in the process. They can be late as well, but you're not getting the official transcript feedback out of an open house at all. Different types of education, having an information display, whether that's, you know, set up in a local community center or something like that, having fact sheets available for people. Interviews, they can get you a tremendous amount of detail. It takes a lot of time and money to conduct those. Surveys, and, you know, we're talking just a generic survey as well as a visual preference type of survey, which is a little bit more specific. They can be very efficient, but if you're doing a survey that you're mailing out and asking people to mail back in, you're going to get a low response rate. Even if you send out an online survey, your response rate can be rather low. Visual preference surveys, those are something that can be a little bit more captivating for people if you are to the point of showing them alternatives, and if you have a project that lends itself to this, you know, you can show them, here's a picture of, you know, this type of a development on this property, here's a picture of this other type of development on this property, which one is best? And you can get a person's a gut reaction to that pretty quickly. And obviously, there's a lot of different things you can do with the internet these days. One thing to be aware of is how current something is. A public participation tool that's not current is not useful, and that's one of the things to watch out for, web-based techniques. Sometimes people put something up and they never go back, they never update it, and it can be a real failing if something's not current. People eventually stop looking at the website entirely. And then access. You know, still to this day, there are many people who do not have access to the web, or they just don't care to access their information in that format. So you might be missing, depending upon where you are, you might be missing a large portion of your public if you rely solely on web-based participation. So typically, it really is best to take a combination of techniques and put them together. This is just an example of a website for, it was a county comprehensive plan update. And it was a very nice website. They did keep it up to date. And, you know, I just want to note that they also used several other things. They had a method that they used. I think they called it a meeting in a box, and it was very low-tech, and they basically had a box that they kept at the county planning agency, and it contained some fact sheets and, you know, basic information like that, and I think a PowerPoint presentation on a CD, you know, if somebody had that, and the local township or boroughs could come to the office, pick up this box, take it back to their regular meeting, and basically go through this information on their own and discuss it. And that was, you know, one of the public participation techniques. So they called it a meeting in a box. Like I said, pretty low tech, but apparently it was fairly successful for them. They had quite a few of their municipalities come in and take it back to their regular meetings and go over it in their own time, at their own pace. A couple other things, small groups. There's a lot of different small group forms officially. Charrettes are typically used for design process or visioning process. Usually there are some professionals involved, but they want citizens in on those as well. The Delphi technique is more specific for sure, and my next slide actually goes into that a little bit more. But with these different things, know the basics of them, know when to use them, you know, at what points they would be useful, what type of project. The Delphi method. This, I would say, you know, this would be used on a technical issue. When there's limited ways to move forward on a project. So if you're looking for visioning, you're not doing the Delphi method. you know, if you're looking at a very specific technical issue and you've got a few different ideas of how it's going and you need your experts to come to a consensus on something, that's when you would use this method. So the three C's of public participation, coalition building, consensus building, and conflict resolution. This is what a planner is always doing to some extent, it seems. And then to accomplish those things, you need to be doing the things on the bottom, you know, understanding that your primary responsibility is to the public, know the background information that you need to know, make sure you identify the leadership in the community and be in contact and coordination with them, but then also reaching beyond them to try and head off any conflict before it even starts or keep it at a minimal level. And I just want to remind you that that one line there, a planner's primary responsibility is to the public, that is from the AICP code directly. Social justice issues and approaches. You know, who gets what in terms of location of infrastructure? There are positive and negative outcomes for every single project, and who is getting what? You know, you cannot do a project these days and force all the negative outcomes on a disadvantaged community. You just can't do things like that. You know, I think 50 years ago, that's how some things were absolutely done. And, you know, the federal law now to prevent that, and certainly as planners, it should certainly be our goal to try and, you know, spread the wealth of positive outcomes for any project. Access to jobs can be a problem. Access to education can be a problem. Things that can be done to address those. For federal projects, anything with federal funding and permits, you can go through an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment, and you've got to do the environmental justice work to prove that you're not burdening a disadvantaged community. More on a local level, and funded by federal dollars, you know, reverse commuting is something that can be done to open up access to jobs and education when they've moved away from population centers. And then brownfield and infill development can be used to try and move those jobs and education back into population centers. The code of ethics is 5% of the exam. You know, 5% of 150 questions is not that many, but the code of ethics, number one, it's going to be something that when you pass this exam, you're going to say that you're going to follow this code of ethics. So that's one reason to know it. And the other reason is I think it's about 8 pages long, so you can read it over, get it in your head, and, you know, have these 5% of questions answered, you know, and move on to other things for the exam. There are 4 parts to the exam. It was revised. If someone has looked into this in the past, please understand it was revised October 3rd of 2009. That added Section D and Rule 26. So, you know, I'm discussing the newest version of it, which is 4 parts, A, B, C, and D. A reviews principles to which we aspire, and these are ideals that we should be committed to. Section B, that is the rules of conduct that we are accountable to. Section C is procedural, how you go about charges and rulings. And D is that new part, and it's very specific, planners convicted of a serious crime, you know, and how that process works. This is available on the APA website. As I said, it's about 8 pages long, so it's not that bad. Go print it and start reading through and getting an understanding of it. For Section A, principles to which we aspire, there are 3 main headings within that. The first one is our overall responsibility to the public. And the quote is, our primary obligation is to serve the public interest. And this, you know, there's a reason that this is the first thing mentioned, overall, you know, it's really something that APA believes in. And when you're looking at questions on the exam, you know, keep in mind that APA feels that a planner's primary obligation is to serve the public interest. And sometimes when you start looking at answers to a question and you start thinking, well, all these could be okay, you know, think about this. You know, the obligation is to serve the public interest. Is one of those answers serving the public interest, whereas the other ones might not be doing that so much? The second part of the principles is our responsibility to clients and employers. And this just talks a lot about independent professional judgment. You know, at the end of the day, you know, you may change jobs 7 times. You know, you'll have a client for a while and never have them again. You know, it is your reputation as a planner. It's your AICP. You need to have independent professional judgment for that. And the third part of the principles is the responsibility to the profession and colleagues. And that just discusses the fact that, you know, as planners, hopefully we are advancing education and research and professional development in regards to planning overall. So the principles to which we aspire, if you're found guilty of violating a portion of this section, the first section, you cannot be sanctioned. So the principles goes with this little cartoon here, which says that, you know, you want to limit unethical behavior, but, you know, it's okay to shake that up a little. That's the principles. The rules of conduct, there's no fuzziness with the rules of conduct. There are 26 rules. There are some topics that come up over and over again in those 26 rules. Conflict of interest is one of those. Accurate information is another. And then the code procedures themselves come up in several different rules. There's definitely overlap between the principles and the rules, and that's really the hardest part of studying the code for the exam, is keeping in mind what are things that are principles versus what are things that are rules, because they can be very similar in some respects. And with the rules, if you are found guilty of violating, you can be removed from AICP or sanctioned in some other manner that APA does not specify. Rule number one of the rules of conduct goes back to providing accurate information. This is really important to APA and to the code. You know, you can't really get anywhere if people are disseminating information that's wrong. So it's rule number one that you need to be providing adequate, timely, clear, and accurate information. And I'm going to skip the next 24 rules because I don't have time to go over them all. But rule number 25 is what I call the catch-all rule. Even if it's not covered in 1 through 24, they've thrown this in here. If you're doing any wrongful act that reflects adversely on your professional fitness, you're breaking the rules of conduct. Rule 26, this is the new one. If you're convicted of a serious crime, essentially you're out of AICP until that's straightened out, is basically what that rule says. The third section, Section C of the code, is the code procedures, and it details in a very step-by-step process how you can seek informal advice, how you can seek formal advice, and how a charge of misconduct is handled, from the filing and investigations through some type of decision on that misconduct charge. And it's a fairly basic step-by-step process, so don't feel like this part is overwhelming here. It works kind of like a court system would work, essentially. The one thing that you cannot do with the code, and this is one of the rules, you have to you have to participate in the process. You cannot take the fifth, essentially, if you're brought up on a charge of misconduct. You have to work with APA and work through the process. In Section D, like I said, this is a very specific section that's new. It defines what they consider a serious crime, and it outlines the process. You're automatically suspended. You can try and petition for reinstatement, and they're going to publish how it works out for anybody who has to go through this process. This part here, you don't need to know for the exam. I can't imagine they would ask you this type of thing, but I just, as somebody who may be a future AICP, I want to just show you, in 2009, there were only 11 ethics cases total. This is not like this is something that comes up every day to APA. I'm unsure right now how many AICPs there are nationwide. In Pennsylvania, there's around 400. So there's not a lot of ethics activity. There were 11 cases for 2009. 9 of them were resolved. 2 of them were still pending at the end of the year. The ethics committee upheld dismissals in 2 cases, and there were actually no requests for formal advice whatsoever. So that was 1 year right there. Trends over the past few years, they're actually, it's been increasing. I don't know if this is because people are, you know, being worse than they used to be, or if people are becoming more familiar with the code and what is an ethics issue. And in the past 5 years, there's only been 2 years that the ethics committee took action, and there's been no request at all for formal advice in 5 years. So the take-home points for the code of ethics, I would say, you know, you have to know the difference between what are principles and what are rules. You need to know how advice can be sought. You need to know how to file charges, how a person can defend themselves from charges. Know who the players and their roles are. The ethics officer is the executive director of APA and AICP, and then there's the ethics commission. And in the section C, the process section, it tells you when the ethics officer is doing something versus the ethics commission doing something. And the little sword here on the right is a reminder, you know, this is APA's code. This is what they want you to do. So if they present you with a scenario question on the test, you know, you're to follow the code. And if it's painful to do that, you know, if it's a question that runs through a scenario and the options end up being, you know, you have to quit your job because you can't carry out this unethical thing that you've been requested to do or required to do by your supervisor, you know, the answer may very well be, yes, you have to quit your job. In real life, I think, and I would certainly hope that we don't get to that point with things. I hope that, you know, as a planner, you start identifying early on when you think there's an issue somewhere, and you work to avoid this endpoint, which requires you to quit your job. But on a test, they're going to run you through a scenario, and they're going to ask you to choose the best answer, and you know you need to choose the APA answer that follows the code of ethics, even if that might be a painful answer. Resources for scenarios for the code. Carol Barrett's book, which we mentioned earlier, is one source. I think we have a couple things on the PA chapter, AICP exam page, and a new source, which I think is really good and free, on the APA ethics page, not on their AICP exam page, but on their ethics page, they have what they call Toolkit for Conducting Ethics Sessions, and it's basically for the chapters when they are putting ethics sessions together for their members, which are required now. You pass the exam, you become an AICP, you're going to have to do certification maintenance training. speaking, and one of the things you're going to be required to have scenarios spelled out. They present a situation, and they say what is the best way to resolve it. So it's brand new. It follows the new code, and it's a good way to get familiar with these scenarios, and definitely some of the ethics questions on your exam will likely be scenarios. Again, it won't be that many. It's only 5% of the exam, but you definitely want to read through some ethics scenarios and get familiar with that. Okay. That's my email up top, Susan Elks, the PDO for the Pennsylvania chapter. And then Chris's email is below that. You can email us if you have any leftover questions you think of later. If you have any trouble finding source material, the timeline or the history chapter from the Green Bible book, feel free to email me for any of that. Some of it is definitely on our website, but if you can't come up with something, definitely email us. Or, again, if you have questions that you think of later, the slides are currently on our website. If this audio has captured properly and the quality is good, we will be putting it on our website as well and making that available to you. If we have any leftover questions that we haven't gotten to today, we are going to post answers to that on the website as well. We're trying to see if there's any that we can address right now quickly for you. There was one question sent in, you know, is New Jersey the only state that has an additional certification process? I don't know that. I am not aware of any others, I have to say. But I'm not sure if it's the only one. I know, you know, in Pennsylvania there's been discussion at various points in times of doing it. But right now New Jersey is the only state I'm aware of that has its own certification process to be a planner. But I could definitely, you know, be unaware of something else that's out there. So thank you for joining us today. Again, as I mentioned earlier, when you log off, there's going to be an evaluation that comes up. If you could please complete that for us, we can improve future sessions. Good luck with your studies and with the exam. Thank you.